this is Wendy Day from Rap Coalition. I'm glad you're tuned in to groundupradio.com. I see you're getting built from the ground up.
Ground Up Radio. Get built from the ground up.
Let's go!
245, Ground Up Radio.
Get ground Up Radio.
VUVM Radio with my man Flawless, Bobby Flawless on the line. And we got a very special guest on the line tonight. You all should know who this lady is. If you don't, if you're a hip hop enthusiast like myself and Flawless, you gotta know this woman.
Legendary.
The name, the legendary. If you know the names David Banner, Cash Money Records, Twista, Razzcast, shoot, even the late great Tupac Shakur, then you should know
Master P.
You should know, when we said the name Wendy Day, you should know that she is a true, true, true power player in the background of these individuals that we just named career. Without further ado, I want to introduce Ms. Wendy Day, representing the Rap Coalition.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Doing well, man.
Great, great.
Yourself.
Thank you for having me.
So many questions, don't even know where to start. But
I know, right?
I got a question, though. What made you just even get into hip-hop, though, Miss Day?
Oh, insanity. I'm kidding, but I'm not kidding. It's one of those things, right? I started listening to hip-hop in 1980, and I'm kind of giving away my age here. But I started listening to hip-hop when it first left New York. I lived in Philadelphia at the time. Mm. You know, I'm born and raised in Philly. And because Philly is only an hour and a half from New York, we got it pretty early. And I was in college, and I went to a concert, and I saw Grandmaster Flash perform at the University of Pennsylvania. I wasn't going to school there. That was just like a neighboring college. But I was so impressed with their energy and their stage presence and, you know, just the whole story of, you know, who they are, and in listening to their raps, I'm like, wow, what's this? This is awesome. And as I got more into it, I realized that I really loved it, and it became a really big part of my life.
Wow.
So from being a fan of hip hop for so long, when did you actually begin to get into the industry, the music industry? What was it that got you into that position?
In 1992, I had moved back to New York City from Montreal. I was in Montreal helping the father of one of my friends run a liquor company. And he had invested in the company, but he was an engineer by trade, so he kind of let me do everything. And I always explain it by saying it was like training wheels, because I didn't have to put up money. He put up all the money, so there was no risk for me, but it showed me that I could take something from nothing and make something. So it gave me the balls, if you will, to go out on my own when I came home. And when I came back to New York, I was very fortunate. I had made a lot of money with the liquor company, and I wanted to do something to help people, and I wanted to do something with rap music, and I couldn't quite figure it out, you know. I've got a master's degree in African American studies, and I knew that I wanted to help people of color start businesses, because I believe that's the way to resolve the struggle, is if you can make your own money and you can have your own control over your own future, then you can get up out of any situation that you're in. So I knew that I wanted to do that, and I wanted to work in music, but I wasn't quite sure, like, how the two would meet, you know? And I took a class in New York at the New School, and it was taught by Burt Padell, who's like an accountant to the stars. And Burt, it was a pop music class, and Burt was talking about how rappers were kind of getting jerked, not kind of, but they were getting jerked by their record labels and by these production companies that were like middlemen between the artist and the record label. And once I learned that, it's like I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I knew what my calling was. And I started a not-for-profit organization called Rap Coalition to help get artists out of bad deals.
Wow. Hmm. So this is, when you started Rap Coalition, what year is this?
1992.
92, okay. And on starting Rap Coalition and moving forward with helping artists, who was the first artist that you took on to help in a predicament of a bad deal?
Jazzz Tempo. They were signed to Def Jam. And, you know, it's funny because Jazzz, I still see Jazzz on Facebook all the time. Jazzz went on to become a designer for Fat Farm, for Aniche, for like some of the really big urban brands that were kicking like in the 90s and the early 2000s. But he was in a rap group with his partner, and they were called Jazzz Tempo, and they were signed to Def Jam, and Russell was just kind of holding them. They weren't, you know, they never came out, and they were very frustrated. And they were the very first artists that I ever pulled out of a record deal.
Okay.
Wow.
So you're doing that. And
by the way, they were like the first of hundreds. And
hundreds.
Most of them, sadly, you wouldn't know necessarily like who they are, because
right.
they did, like their careers didn't go the way they were supposed to, hence me coming in and breaking the contract.
Right.
But then there's some that you would know, like Common. I helped pull Common off of Relativity, Killer Priest off of Geffen. So just a lot of different artists that were in bad situations that needed to move on.
Well, those rappers back then, they were just signing bad contracts, just happy to get on, so they just signed anything.
I think that's what it is. You know, first of all, the rap community is a community where lawyers aren't people that you naturally do business with, you know? Like, in the rap community back then, lawyers were, like, people you went to see if you caught a case. They weren't necessarily something that you were comfortable with, you know? Most rappers don't have an uncle that's a lawyer, you know? So there's sort of a system that's in place outside of what their experience is. And the labels know this, and the labels very much take advantage or took advantage of this.
Right.
And a lot of what I did with Rap Coalition, and everything we did at Rap Coalition was for free. It was a not-for-profit. And then the way that I funded the company was to do the deal. So the deals that I've done that I've gotten paid for, I've actually put the money back into the not-for-profit so that we could continue educating artists. But a lot of the early work that I did was introducing rappers to lawyers just so that when they went to negotiate their deals, they wouldn't get taken advantage of.
Wow.
Awesome. Okay.
Wow.
So moving forward, you mentioned a couple of names that we are familiar with, like Common, which is one of my favorite MCs, Flawless as well, I'm sure. But who was the first artist you took on that was like known to like the national spotlight? So,
wow. I don't know if I can answer that, because for what I did, I didn't really pay attention to like who was famous and who wasn't. Maybe at the time, Quest the Mad Lad, he was signed to Def American.
I remember him too.
Yeah, he might have been the first. Wow, I hate to commit to that, because I didn't really pay attention to who was famous and who wasn't. It was more like whoever needed help got help, you know?
Right. Okay. Okay. So when was it that you realized that, you know, you're helping artists, you're getting them out of these deals and getting them in better situations? When is it that you realize I got a reputation now? You know, when you had people that were, you know, I'm pretty sure people, you know, you didn't have to go out and campaign to say, hey, I can get your deal, you know, get you out your deal.
Never. It kind of happened organically. After I pulled, there was a group called Chameleons, and they were signed to 4th and Broadway. And one of the guys in the Chameleons, his name was Popan, his cousin, or maybe it was his manager's cousin, anyway, somebody in their organization, one of their cousins was running a label out in Richmond, California for a guy named Master P. And because Popan trusted me so much from what they went through in pulling them out of their crappy deal, he referred me to this guy, and they were in the midst of negotiating a contract with Priority Records, and they were a little bit concerned because the guy that was doing the negotiating was signed to Priority Records, and they weren't sure if it was a good deal or if the guy was kind of serving them up in order to benefit his own career at Priority.
Right.
So basically I stepped in and I helped them negotiate that deal. It turned out that the guy negotiating the deal was doing a good deal. He was being fair. But of course they didn't know that at the time. And for me it was a great first deal to be a part of because he got to retain his masters, and it was an 80-20 split. So it was a really wonderful situation to be part of. The frustrating side of it for me was that I didn't get to do the direct negotiations. It was almost like sitting in the back seat. You know how when you sit in the back seat and you're giving somebody directions? It's always harder than when you're driving and you can just turn left or turn right. And I learned from that experience, as great as that deal was and as proud as I am to have been part of it, I really learned that too many cooks in the kitchen makes it really hard to get shit done. So I decided from that point forward that I would do deals for artists that had leverage, like Master P. You know, he had leverage when we did that deal. But I would make sure that it was just like me and an attorney, whether it was my attorney or whether it was the artist's attorney, negotiating the deal, because then we could have more control over the value of the deal and the areas. Most lawyers and outside people, when they do a deal, they want to get as much money up front, but that's not always what's in the best interest for the artist. You know, sometimes you want to get extra perks in the deal, like in David Banner's deal. If Universal hadn't sold at least 300,000 units of his first album, he would have been able to take his masters and leave. And that has so much more value than money, because it means if they screwed up his career, he could go elsewhere.
Right.
You know, so I wanted to be in control of the deal so that I could do that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Because Master P, his deal, he did have an 80-20 split, though. He's like one of the first.
Yes. If not, I think it was the first, actually.
Okay.
Certainly the first in rap.
Okay.
And then from there, I went on to do Twista's deal, which was a 50-50 split at Atlantic. After Twista's deal, I think the Eminem deal came next. And then Cash Money
deal. That's one of the biggest deals in hip hop to date.
Yeah, that's what they.
Yeah,
it's funny. I kind of made history on that one.
It was what, like, was it $30 million?
Yes, that was actually the value of the deal, but the guys were so successful that It actually became more than a $30 million deal. But when we negotiated it, it was, a $30 million deal.
Because Cash Money, they was independent in the beginning. And they was already rolling, wasn't they?
Yes, they put out 31 records over a six-year period.
31 albums?
Yeah, 31 albums, 31 CDs over a six-year period.
I remember some of those, too, like BG's first records and everything.
Exactly, Chop the City for Ghetto.
UNLV. All on you.
Pimp Daddy.
Yeah. Yeah, that, wow. And then to just roll, I mean, now, with them having a success independently like that, I imagine that was a leverage piece for them as well, on the chessboard. Okay.
Yeah. And you'll notice, like, if you look at the history of my deals, they're all leverage deals. Like, if somebody didn't have leverage, I wasn't really interested in negotiating their deal, because you can't get a great deal for somebody unless they've got something of value that they're bringing to the table, more than just talent.
Like,
talent is not enough in this industry. You've got to really have a decent-sized following, or you've got to be making income of some sort. You've got to be a proven entity. And by, with Cash Money, by them proving that they could sell units, it was kind of a no-brainer. In fact, when I first came on board, the most they had sold of any album was 25,000 units. And to a label, that's not great. Like, that back then, it was kind of low sales. Today, it's great. But back then, it was kind of like, you could do better. And in watching what they were doing, because they were selling mostly like 5,000 and 10,000, but then they put out BG and it was 25,000. And I realized they were only working their records for like 6 weeks. And they were only working them in Louisiana and Texas. And then after 6 weeks, they'd move on to the next one. And that's how they were able to put out like 5 albums a year. So when I came on board and the labels were saying to me, in the midst of negotiating, they were saying, hey, these guys don't really sell a lot. They put out a lot of music, but the reception to them isn't great. I went back to the guys and said, okay, we need to, whatever we put out next, we need to really bump the numbers up so that it looked amazing to the majors. And so we increased their marketing area from Louisiana and Texas to include all of the South and the Midwest. And remember, I had already done Twista's deal, and I was really close to Do or Die. I helped put out their first record. So I had all of the relationships in the Midwest that we needed, so we were able to expand. And then my lawyers, who were negotiating the deal with me, they also represented 3-6 Mafia. So they were able to get Cash Money to go out and tour with 3-6 all through the South. And the next record that they put out, which was, I think it was Big Time. I can't remember what it was. But the next, and once they did 75,000, a bidding war ensued. And we did like 75,000 like in a month. I mean, we sold really, really, really fast.
That is strange.
Wow. Numbers count. Numbers count. So, Wendy, with everything that you were doing up to that point, and you being, proficient in negotiating these deals, I'm sure that you faced a lot of pushback from the labels. Am I wrong?
Yes and no. And if everybody always says, man, the labels hate you. And I always smile when they say that, because even today, like when I call them, they pick up my call immediately. So if they hate me, I don't see it. Maybe behind my back they do, but I've made them so much money that it's kind of hard to hate me, Like, I'm always very respectful when I pull somebody out of a deal. And I never pull somebody out of a deal that's really profitable for them, because if it's profitable, they're not going to be fucking it up. Can I curse?
Right. Yeah, all day.
Okay, good. If I'm pulling somebody out of a deal, it's not like it's Drake, who's, the number one artist at Spotify, and I'm pulling them off of Universal. Artists that are financially successful are never the problem. It's the artists that aren't very successful. The labels just kind of like forget about them and move on to the next person. And what the labels don't realize is, like, that's the artist's life and livelihood. So when they shelve them, it's not like they can go and make music elsewhere because they're signed to that label. It's like they're fucked. They end up having to, like, go get a job at UPS or whatever.
Right.
And I just never thought that was right.
Oh, man. Yeah, that definitely wouldn't feel good to, you know, have a record out and, you know, done some shows and been some places, and then after it's over with, you got to go back to the regular 9-to-5, you know, and yeah, that sucks.
Exactly.
Hey, Wendy.
Exactly. Especially if they got a little bit famous.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine being a little bit famous and then you're working the drive-thru at McDonald's?
Oh, man.
I just can't imagine, like the ego hit that would, you know, incur. I can't imagine that.
Because one of your interviews I heard and saw, you said you saw Biggie still on the train. That blew my mind.
Yes,
after he dropped
first,
the album.
You know, when he first came out, because the artists don't make money. And you know, I also saw him riding in a Benz. So I don't want to imply that he was dead broke, but I remember seeing Evil D from Black Moon on the train. I remember seeing Craig Mack on the train. I remember seeing Papoose on the train.
Mm.
You know, in New York, we take the train because it's fast and it's convenient as well as cheap. So I don't want to imply that he was completely broke because he got in advance, but he wasn't living in a mansion in New Jersey when that first album came out. You know, he was.
And it's usually the first albums, right? The first albums,
yeah.
They usually don't make no money on the first albums.
Right, because they usually get advanced money, and then in some situations it takes a while for that first album to come out. So they might be advanced, you know, 50 grand or 75 grand, but it's got to last them for 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. So moving forward, I've seen you in one of your interviews just recently that you had a business relationship with Pop.
Yes.
You know, prior to his death.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah, and I in the interview I noticed that you said that he was in the deal with Death Row. He had the 3-album deal, and he was, you know, under the impression that once he dropped you know, the 7-Day Theory, Machiavelli album, that he was finished. But you said that wasn't the case.
No.
Because he was, you know, they still had to get the approval from the label, correct?
Yes. There's a difference between delivering an album and acceptance.
Okay.
You can sign a 5-album deal and go to them and hand them 5 albums and say, here you go, bye, thanks. But it doesn't work that way. The label has to accept the album and actually put it into the distribution system so that it's starting to be released, and then you're able to move on. And most contracts stipulate that you have to work that album. So even if you move on, you have to help them market and promote whatever that last release is.
Okay. Wow, okay, that's gang. Well, you know, some artists who think they might be in a playful situation that they're in now, just thinking, well, if I, you know, I drop this album and this album and then give a greatest hits, that's not necessarily going to get them, you know, out of that deal that the record label says.
And there's even a clause that says that they can't count a greatest hits album. So if you've got a 5-album deal and you deliver 3 and then you do a greatest hits, when you do the next album, it's number 4. It's like the greatest hits doesn't even count as a release.
I know a lot of artists do that. They try to give a greatest albums for the last one, like a best of or something like that. So.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that was like what Michael Jackson did with was it Sony or
the History, you know, album?
It was a History, and then I think it was the greatest hits. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I don't know. I never followed his career. Like, my world is rap, and I'm extremely ignorant outside of rap. So I really have no clue.
that's beautiful. That's beautiful to hear you say that, though. I mean, you know, you just definitely have a strong love for this culture, and
I do. I do. I love to rap. Like, I don't listen to other music. And in a way, it's a little bit tunnel visioned, but it's just, you know, it's my choice.
It's the music that I like.
That's awesome.
I would have thought you follow EDM and everything. Like, but how do you make money in that too? You know?
I don't. Okay. The only reason I even recognize names is because every now and again I'll look at the charts because I want to see like what's selling and what people are relating to. And every now and again I'll see a name that I don't recognize and I'll Google it, and it's usually an EDM artist. I'm like, oh, that's who that is. So I've learned, like, who Avicii is, and I'm probably not even pronouncing it right, but I've learned, like, a lot of different guys in EDM only because I see them on the charts.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's great. So we covered a little of your background with, you know, working with artists in the past as far as, like, you know, I would say, like, into the 90s on the, and then we're going into, like, say, 2000 and beyond. And you know, we known that over the over that time gap, things have changed as far as like
absolutely, you know, like the whole industry changed. And you know, I did David Banner's deal in 2003, and I noticed that there was less music being released into the marketplace, but I didn't know why. And I thought maybe the labels had just like hit a glut and had too many artists signed, so they weren't signing anything new. And then in 2005, I was shopping Bootsy and Webby for Trill Entertainment. And although I didn't end up negotiating their deal for them, I realized that things were changing at the major labels. It was a lot harder to get meetings for Bootsy and Webby, because Bootsy and Webby were, in my opinion, more successful than the Cash Money artists because they were selling more units independently.
Wow.
And when the labels didn't see it my way, I was a little bit shocked, you know?
Okay. Yeah.
And the deal offers were considerably lower. Like, I think the deal for them that they took started at like $165,000. And I'm like, wait, that doesn't make sense, because these guys are making like millions of dollars in show money and in sales. And then right after, I ended up falling out with the guys from Trill, so I didn't negotiate that deal. I walked away from it. They ended up signing to Asylum. And then right after they did that deal, 360 deals came into effect. And
what year was that?
Say it again?
And what year was that when the 360 deals...
05 was when 360 deals came in. So at that point, like, I was so like disgusted by 360 deals that I'm like, you know what, I'm not gonna shop deals anymore. Like, this isn't what I'm gonna do. So at that point I changed my business model and started teaching up and coming artists and labels how to stay independent and make the lion's share of the money themselves, because it didn't make sense to me to give up half of your money to a label when you're already, in my opinion, underpaid. So you're always, the artist is always the last person to get paid, and they don't make that much unless they're a superstar. Like Beyonce and Drake, they're going to be okay, I promise. But like a new or up and coming artist, they don't make so much money that they can afford to give up 50% of their income to a major label, or 30% of their show money to a label. And I had a real problem with that. So I decided to stop doing deals. And that's when I started building independent labels. And to be honest, I haven't looked back. Like, it's just been awesome. Like, right now I'm working with a guy here in Atlanta called Trouble. Trouble's part of Duct Tape, and Trouble is independent. And independently, he's making between $80,000 and $120,000 a month. So why sign to a major label when, even if he doesn't grow, and we already know he's going to grow because he's not going to go backwards, right? So even if he doesn't grow and stays right at the position he is right now, he's going to make $1 million by the end of the year. You know, and by the end of the year, I mean in March, because we started really making good money for him in March of last year. So by the end of February this year, he'll be a millionaire. Why would we want to go and do a deal and give up part of that?
Yeah, because the deals today, they're not going to get nowhere near what they used to get.
No. And he was in Cali shooting a video with Drake yesterday. He's got a Drake song coming. So why, you know, unless a label makes such an amazing offer that, you know, he can't say no, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, does. Explain to, I need you to explain, Wendy, too, because we got a lot of artists here that's trying to make it a 360 deal. They still want a record deal for some reason. I don't know why. I'd be trying to explain
to them. I can't figure that out either. I guess it's just that old school mentality. A 360 deal is where the label takes half of your, half of everything, half of publishing, half of your merchandising. If you write a book, they get half of that. If you star in a movie, they get half of that.
Even books and all that too?
Yes. Sponsorship.
Hey.
If you get sponsored by Samsung, they get half of that.
That is crazy.
They get half of all your income, and then for your show money, they're kind enough to let you only have to pay them 30% so that you get to keep 70%. But my argument is, if the label's not booking you the shows and they're not putting you on the tours, why should they get 30% of the cut? It just doesn't make sense to me. And of course, their argument is, well, we made you a star, so you couldn't have gotten the shows if we didn't do our job. But that's your job. Like, that's what a record label is supposed to do. You're supposed to build somebody to be famous enough where they can make money from their art form.
Right. Well, they say units are not selling like they used to. That's why they have to put out the 360 deal now, because the physical CDs are not selling like they used to when Busta and Redman and
cut the budget. So I totally get that, but they cut the budget. So they said CDs aren't selling, so we can't put $1 million into marketing you anymore. We can only put $500,000 into marketing you. Okay, so you're cutting the budget and you're getting a bigger cut on the back end too. It just seems excessively greedy to me, but then I'm pro artist, so, you know, maybe I'm wrong. But my attitude has been, there's just no reason to do a deal. You know, for the clients that I've worked with, it's been easier for them to find investors than it is to find a record deal. And then once they find an investor, they can work out their own split with the investor, but the joy of that is they get complete control over where that money's spent, because it's their investor, so they get to say where the money's going to go.
Right.
And there's so many people out here that know how to work records that you can hire somebody to help you with the marketing and promotion. You don't need a record label anymore.
Online distribution now, TuneCore, CD Baby, there's so many outlets.
Exactly.
Yeah, and then the streaming is taking over a lot as well.
It sure is. If you're not signed to a label, streaming money is really good money.
A lot of people argue about Spotify. They say Spotify don't pay you that much, but I'm like, we should get something.
That's because they're in a record deal. You've never heard an independent artist say that Spotify doesn't pay them enough. If you're in a record deal, I agree, because the label, your deal is the label only has to pay you 12 to 15% of the income after you recoup, and most artists don't recoup. So when they get streamed on Spotify, they're not seeing any money. But when you're independent and you're streaming on Spotify, you're getting all of that income.
Right.
You're getting 100% of that income, and then you split it with your investor, you know, whatever your agreement is. And it could be 25-75, where, you know, you keep 75 and give the investor 25%, or it could be 50-50. It just really depends on your leverage.
Right. And where it keeps coming up, leverage. Leverage. That's important. That's important.
Everywhere in life.
That's the key right there.
Yeah, leverage is the key.
So basically, the artists need to go ahead and start their own fan base.
Yeah.
Get their own fan base going.
That's where the money is. If you can build your own fan base, that's what's going to convince an investor or a label, if you want to go that route. That's what's going to convince them, because if you've got, you know, 20,000 people that are willing to pay money to see you perform and pay money to stream your music or pay money to download your music or pay money to buy your t-shirt, that shows them that with your limited resources, you found people that will financially support you. And if there's 10,000 or 20,000 or 30,000 people willing to support you, then as they put you out internationally and put a real budget behind you, there's going to be millions of people willing to support you.
Wow.
It becomes a mathematical equation.
Right, exactly. And I noticed you mentioned t-shirts and, you know, leaning towards merchandise. And, you know,
yeah.
I always, you know, the artists that, you know, we deal with over at Ground Up Radio, you know, we support the independent artists as a, you know, as much as we do a major label artist. But I always, you know, people always talk to me and ask, you know, Q, you know, I want to do this, I want to do that. And I say, hey, look, you got to get some merchandise. Do you feel, so obviously you definitely feel that's important for, you know,
oh my
somebody
God.
That's going out doing shows.
I'm actually wearing a Trouble t-shirt right now. It's
okay.
a phrase from one of his songs.
Okay.
It says, you know, can't get involved too deeply. It's the beginning of a song he has called Ready, and he took that phrase and he put it on t-shirts. And the funny thing is, there are kids buying it off of the internet who aren't even Trouble fans, but they see that and they're like, wow, can't get involved too deeply. I like that. That's my motto. I'm gonna buy that and rock it.
Mm-hmm. That's something. And it's crazy that, you know, you just said that they're not even Trouble fans, but they like the words so much. And you
exactly.
know, I'm glad you're saying it. Yeah, I'm glad you're saying it, Wendy, because we want these artists to soak all that up and you know, get out there. You know, just because you may your music, you know, if you're a trap rapper, you know, and you know, necessarily, like, you might have some fans that are not into trap, but you got a phrase that can plug into. There you go. There's
or
money
you,
right
or
there.
Or you have a song, that resonates with them, you know, about
right.
struggle. Like, everybody can relate to struggle. So
right.
you might make a song as a trap rapper talking about struggle. And in the song, you're really talking about running from the cops and having to, you know, move your operation around and switch
mm-hmm.
burner phones. But in
mm-hmm.
the song, you're not saying that. You're talking about struggle. And then some kid who's in college struggling on his midterms or struggling to get through his finals is like,
right.
man, that's my jam. Like, I
right. that's the power of this music, though, Wendy. You
that's
know,
the
just...
power of music, yeah. Yes.
Oh,
yes.
And the power of the internet, man. The internet.
That's
exactly.
Cool. Yeah, that too, definitely. So speaking of the internet, Wendy, you got a few sites that you're up on.
I got a little gangster with it this year. what really happened, guys? Like, the truth behind this is, in August, I was online and I was like dum dee dum dee dum dee dum, you know, just searching, and I saw a website that was teaching artists how to get a record deal, and I wrote a book a couple years ago about how to get a record deal. So the truth is out there, like the information of how to really get a deal and build leverage is out there. You can find it. So I pull up this website. And whoever this guy is, I don't even know who he is. Like, I've never heard of him before in my life. And I've been doing this, like, 25 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this guy is saying, yeah, you got to get your demo together. And then you got to pay to take a meeting at a record label. And then once you meet with them, you spend, like, $5,000. And then you can get a deal. And I'm like, wait a minute. 25 years? I don't know anybody who's been able to get a deal like that. And it really pissed me off. So, you know, there's a lot of shit in the world that pisses me off, and I look the other way, and that's what I did. I was like, hey, whatever, fuck it. You know, let the buyer beware. Anybody who falls for this is stupid anyway. And then
right.
I got an email from this kid in New York, in Long Island, and he said, wow, Wendy, I just paid this guy, and he's somebody who's pretty well-known in the music industry, and I won't blow him up here, but he's somebody that... inside the industry, we know that he's kind of full of shit, but everybody knows who he is, and we tolerate him because he's likable, you know, and he knows a lot of people, and he's been doing this a long time. And this kid sent this guy I guess a couple thousand dollars to evaluate his music, and he got burned. And he's like, you know, I got scammed, I'm so upset, and I'm like, wow, that really sucks. And then that week, I got emails from two other people who asked me if the guy's site was legit, who hadn't gotten burned yet. So what I did was the two guys who were coming up who hadn't gotten burned, I put them in touch with the guy who did get burned. That way it wasn't me saying don't do it, it was somebody who got burned saying, hey, here's what happened to me, and I'm guessing, you know, this may happen to you too. If it doesn't, you know, great, but this is what happened to me. So they ended up not getting burned out of a couple thousand dollars, and I'm like, man, I got to be able to do this bigger. Like, what if these guys hadn't emailed me, and it happened to be all within a 10-day period? Well, what if that hadn't happened? And I'm like, you know what? I got to go online and help educate these kids. So I happened to mention it to Jordan Power. And Jordan is a guy who was a filmmaker. He was a big video guy back in the 90s and the 2000s. And I saw that he was doing some stuff online, and he said to me, he has a YouTube channel, and he said, come to my house, I'm going to set up a YouTube channel for you, and you can post videos, and you can talk about, like, all the fraud. And I'm like, you know what, even better, you set up the account for me and show me how to do it, and I'll just teach them how to do it themselves, and they won't need to pay anybody, they won't need to get ripped off. I said, and I can beat their price because I'll do it for fucking free. And Jordan's like, I love to come over. So I went to his house. He set up the account for me. He showed me how to record. He showed me, like, really basic how to edit. And I mean really basic because, you know, I do no editing. It's just too time consuming. And now I drop 3 videos a week, and then I go live every Wednesday night so artists can call me and – not call me, but they can tune in. And they can ask me, they can say, hey, Wendy, you know, is such and such in the industry legitimate? And, of course, I won't blow anybody up publicly, but I will reach back out to them privately and give them my input, you know. Unless somebody's an extreme douchebag, then, of course, I'm going to blow them up publicly. But for the most part, rather than see somebody get jerked, I answer their question in a way where they can do it themselves, so that they don't need to hire the person who is not legitimate.
Got it.
Wow.
What's the name of your YouTube channel? I mean, I'll subscribe to
this
it.
This is Wendy Day.
This is Wendy Day. You gotta make sure you go view, subscribe, share. You gotta do that.
You've gotta subscribe to it, because here's what I found. That if you don't subscribe and you don't have your notifications up when I go live, it's really hard to find. You know, I go live every Wednesday, and I'm in my 14th week. This Wednesday coming up will be 15. So when you Google Wendy Day Live, you get like 14 episodes that come up. And if you're not there every week, you don't know which one is this week. So it's a little confusing. And then I've also archived them at rapjewels.com.
Rapjewels.com. For free.
And I'll take it a step further. Like, for the folks who really tune in and watch them, if there's a question that comes up a lot, I'll make a video about it. There was a producer who hit me last week and said, I see that you've made, you've answered questions about producers, but you never made a video about producers. And I thought to myself, yeah, I have. And then I went over to Rap Jewels and I looked and I'm like, oh my God, I never did a video for producers.
That's what
So this past week I posted a video for producers.
Flawless, yes. Flawless, go get on there, brother.
Really?
Exactly. I had a question for producers. How do producers get paid today? Because I see I'm a producer myself, man.
Yep, it's in the video.
It's in the video.
It's absolutely in the video. Yep.
I appreciate that. For free. And this information is for free. Y'all guys better jump on this.
Yep,
this is crazy.
And then I've also started a podcast because I learned that there's a lot of people out there who like have real jobs and they can't just sit and watch videos at their job. So they can put, like a headset on for their phone.
Exactly.
Like an earpiece. and they can sit there and listen to the podcast. Yeah. So I've also started a podcast series which is called Rapponomics, and it's on iTunes, it's on SoundCloud, and it's free. That's free as well. And then of course there's my blog, which is Industry Report, and that's just articles. And I try to tie the articles into the videos. Like I try to be as complete as possible. But there are some videos that don't have articles, and there's some articles that don't have videos. So if you like to read, the blog is a great place to go to get, you know, to get up to the date information.
Okay. Get them from all angles.
Get it from all. Yeah. Now you put your. We know that you wrote the book How to Get a Record Deal.
Yeah.
And you put that back out. You now have it on audiobook with the Rick the Ruler.
How about that? Isn't that cool? And he volunteered to do that.
Wow, that's dope.
I wrote the book in 2011, in September of 2011. I put it out. And then in March, I updated it so that it would be a little bit more current. And he happened to he's my friend, but he happened to read the updated version. And he called me and he said, you know, Wendy, our community doesn't like to read. And I'm like, well, they're going to have to fucking learn how to read. And he's like, no, I have a better idea. And he said, why don't we shoot a video about how to get a record deal? And I'm like, Rick, you're in New York. I'm in Atlanta. It just doesn't make sense to shoot a video. It's going to cost us a fortune to do it. He's like, okay. What about an audiobook? And I'm like, you know what? I love that because I listen to audiobooks.
Yeah,
right. Whenever I'm driving, I've got audiobooks playing. So I'm like, wow, why didn't I think of that? That's fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
So it took him about 3 months because his schedule's a little bit nuts. And he sent me the audiobook. And I'm like, this is fabulous.
Wow. Go get that audiobook, y'all.
Exactly.
Slick Rick the Ruler.
Did it.
A legend. Yeah, so that's awesome.
I'm so honored.
Hey, Wendy, how important is also we try to tell the artists, me and Q45 here at Ground Up Radio, we try to explain to the artists to learn about publishing.
Yes.
How important is that to
how important it is it? Very. Publishing is the ownership of the music. So if you don't have control over your ownership, then you can't really do anything with it. Whoever owns the music is the one who decides where it can come out, whether it's going to be in commercials, whether it can be in video games, whether it's placed in a movie or a TV show, and you get paid for that. Publishing is like real estate. You can sell it, you can rent it, but you should never give it away. If you owned a plot of land, you're never going to say, hey, Wendy, here's some free land, take it. You're
going
to always either sell it or rent it.
Right. Yeah, that same as like copyrights as well, right?
Copyright is the ownership of the words of the song. So if you've got a song that you've written, it's the proof that you own it. A copyright is a little bit different from the publishing. It's the registration with the U.S. government that says who exactly owns the song.
Got it. So that's the reason Rapper Forte was able to get a little bit of money out of Drake for his lyrics a couple years back from when Drake did that song with Lil Wayne. Was it Who You Love? Yeah.
Interesting. Drake also quoted Trinidad James in a chorus or something, I believe, because I think he also gets a check.
Really? Okay.
Just for quoting it?
I can't remember what song it is, but I know that Trinidad James owns a piece of it.
Wow.
Maybe it's not Drake.
But regardless of whoever it is, their paperwork is important.
Exactly.
The paperwork is important.
That publishing is very, very important.
Oh, my God.
Wendy, in your opinion, now, you've been doing this for over 25 years. You've been a fan of hip-hop longer than that. You've seen
you know, the trends. You've seen how, you know, how rap is, some people saying it's getting worse, some people saying it's growing. What, in your opinion,
They say every generation says rap is ruined, rap is destroyed. You know, I was telling a friend today who was complaining about Lil Yachty, I was laughing, and he's like, why are you laughing? And I said, because everything you just said about Lil Yachty is what they used to say to me about Master P. Like, my little circle of purists, after I did Master P's deal, were not proud of me.
Oh, really?
They were like, yo, how could you do that? Like, he's garbage. He can't rap. He's ruining hip-hop. Oh, my God, you ruined hip-hop. You know, and I laughed. Like, after I did his deal, I sent a press release to The Source because I was so proud to be part of that deal. And right. The editor at the time called me and was like, Wendy, I'm sorry, I can't print this. I'm like, what do you mean you can't print this? Like, I don't think Master P is ever going to blow up. I don't think he's really going to ever be something. I'm like, dude, he is huge, huge in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Well, we're just going to have to wait and see because, you know, I don't know. I'm really not feeling him. I'm like, all right. 2 months later, I get a call saying, okay, we're ready to write that article.
That is crazy. Because I remember P before, you know, before the big, you know, before he blew up, so to speak. I remember, yeah. I'm a Midwest guy. I remember 99 Ways to Die and the ghetto trying to kill me and everything. And like,
you would definitely remember that because when I was working with Do or Die and Twista, we did a trade-off. We had Master P's team work Do or Die in the Bay Area and then Creator's Way, our team in Chicago, worked 99 Ways to Die. We worked TRU, X's album, which I can't remember the name of.
Was that Mama
West
Drama?
West Coast Ballers and Down South Hustlers.
Yes, those were classics.
We hung the posters, and you know, for like the rest of Master P's career, I always laugh because I'll see him in interviews say, "Yeah, Chicago was my second biggest market." And I, you know, whenever I see that, I'm like, yeah, damn right. We did a lot of work in Chicago for him. We hung posters and gave out music and flyers and.
I'm definitely proof of that because I remember being a young kid, young guy back then, you know, and me and my guys, you know, we riding out. P, everything was P, play that West Coast Bad Boys, play this, play that. Everything you just named, we came up off of that stuff. So
Exactly.
That's amazing. That's amazing to hear that you were a part of that, you know.
Yeah.
But
we worked hard, and our street team was huge in Chicago.
Well,
and
I want to say thanks.
Chicago was so broken up into different, you know, the world calls them gangs, I call them organizations. The city's so broken up into different organizations that we couldn't just go anywhere and work. So we had to make sure that we had somebody from every neighborhood working their own neighborhood. So we had a street team of like hundreds of people working Do or Die and Twista. And of course, you know, we traded out the shit with No Limit.
Wow. Street teams. Do you feel that street teams are still important nowadays or does the internet?
I still use them for trouble.
Okay.
You gotta
All
have
right.
the streets. You can't just have the internet. You've gotta have the streets. You still need people in the barbershop talking about your artist and you still need kids in high school and college students. And the internet is wonderful because you can spread shit worldwide, but you can't just have the internet. If I only work an artist on the internet and I do a live show, I'll have like 20 people in the venue. But if I do the street and the internet, I can have 500 to 1,000 people in the venue.
Makes sense.
I look at the internet like it's another market. So, like with Trouble, we worked all of Georgia, all of Alabama, Northern Florida, North Carolina, and South Carolina, and the internet.
Got it.
So to me, it's just it's another market. But we didn't work the internet and then South Carolina, North Carolina. Like the streets were very, very important to us.
Got it.
And his buzz reflects that.
Oh yeah, indeed. I hear his songs. I know that song he has with Young Thug. I was hearing it a lot this past year.
Yeah.
I was hearing it a lot. You know.
Yeah.
Now,
I remember seeing Trouble. You know, it's good to see success like that, because I remember seeing Trouble before with Alley Boy.
Yes,
on the
he was really struggling, but he had Buffin. He was really bubbling, but they couldn't get him to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay. they built him big in Atlanta, but once you left Atlanta, it was really all about Alley Boy.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Whoa. So Wendy, you got the internet on smash with all of your I think you missed in some of your sites, but I think you still got a few more that we didn't even touch on. Like the one what's the one that I think maybe it just launched, the Slaves, is it Slaves No More? Is that what it was called, or am I saying
Slaves,
it wrong?
Yeah, Slaves No More hasn't launched yet. Slaves No More is it's going to be an educational website. It's going to be like an organized version of what I'm doing with YouTube, only it goes deeper. For the past 3 years, I've been filming like my friends in the music business. Like I've got like a 3-hour interview with Travis from Strange Music. Travis is Tech N9ne's partner.
Yeah, Travis O'Gwen. Yeah.
Yeah. Travis gave up so much game in that interview that I've been able to break that down into like 9 different sections to help educate people on how to start a label.
Mm-hmm.
It's really amazing. So what I'm doing is putting them together like in a cohesive form so that you can start at number one, like unit number one, and you can go all the way to unit number 52. And you can do this over a 1-year period. So you can go in and you can learn as much as you can about the music industry, but it's really in depth. It's not like on YouTube, if I go longer than 10 minutes, I lose people. And
right.
I can see from my statistics, like after about 8 to 10 minutes, people kind of drop off. So if I do a video and it's 17 minutes long, it's like they're missing half of the jewel.
Mm.
So what I've done is I'm building a website, and it's going to be videos, it's going to be PDFs, it's going to be text files, audio. It's all different kinds of ways to receive information in depth about a different topic.
Okay.
So instead of 8 minutes on how to choose a manager, it's going to be a good, 3 hours of research on how to find a manager.
Okay. That's necessary. That's definitely necessary, especially with the new generation. Everything is all digital with them. You know,
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But I also want to get them used to reading. You know, the videos are great, but you can't make a video out of a contract. You know, there's still things that you have to read, and I need for our community to get comfortable with reading so that things aren't hidden from them.
Okay. That's the
And then with that site, there's going to be a fee. It's probably going to be something like $5 or $6 a month to join. I want it to be like the price of a magazine. But I want there to be some commitment, because I've noticed that even with giving out the free information, because it's free, a lot of people are like, yeah, whatever, how much value can it have? It's free.
Right.
So I want artists to get used to paying something. I don't want to, I don't want to kill them over it, but, I want them to get used to, $5 a month or whatever.
Yeah, investing in themselves.
Exactly. I think it's like the price of a magazine or the price of a Happy Meal.
Right. A lot of guys, they mess that up over, a pack of cigarettes or, that bag that they, just blew down or whatever, what I mean?
Exactly. I watched a guy that I work with once tell a producer that he couldn't pay him for a beat, and then as soon as he got off the phone, we were getting ready to go out, and he pulled on a brand new pair of Jordans. And I looked down at his feet, and I'm like, are they new? And he's like, yeah, man, I just got them. They dropped on Tuesday. Man, I paid $300 for these bitches. Aren't they clean? And
wow.
I'm like, wow. And you just told that man you couldn't give him $100 for a beat.
That part.
Like, that broke my heart. I'm like, wow. A pair of Jordans has more value to you than the beat that you just rapped over.
Exactly. Wow, that's...
I don't understand that mentality.
No. Especially if you see yourself, you want to see yourself make it, you know. Yes. Yeah,
I think a lot of artists, there's so much free stuff on the internet too, like for beats and stuff, so, you know, they don't take it that serious, I'm saying. They can get free beats and all that stuff, so.
They don't. So, and you're right, it's driven down the price of beats.
I'm definitely gonna go back to the live stream you had for the producers just to hear that, because that's what I need to really figure out, how that the producer thing is going. It just blows my mind how
you got it. You almost have to develop a name for yourself before you can get paid. And it didn't used to be this way. It's because it's so oversaturated now with producers. You know, it used to be that if you had a hot beat, somebody would buy it from you. And in today's world, it's like if you have a hot beat and somebody can't get it from you either for free or for like $50, they'll bring it to their man and say, hey, make this beat for me. And then dude will copy your beat, change a little bit of something, and then give it to dude for free because it's his boy.
Wow.
See how the game is so... I don't know, Wendy. The game is crazy.
Yeah, it can be very ugly.
Yeah.
So where do you see the game going in the next year or so? Like, I see a lot of artists, like me and Q45 talked about this before. Rolling Stone and all these other artists are still torn at that age. You think rap, hip-hop will, like artists like Snoop? I think Snoop will be able to still do it at an old age.
I think Snoop will. I think guys like Snoop and Slick Rick, like the guys who really stood out, but I don't think Nice and Smooth will be able to tour. I don't think like the smaller legacy act will be able to tour. I think that the superstars can. I see rap getting younger now. As I'm traveling through high schools and colleges promoting artists, I see what kids say about rappers. And even though we criticize, you know, my generation, not me, but my generation criticizes like the Uzi Verts and the Lil Yachty's, the kids relate to them because they're their generation, it's their age.
Right.
And it would be like when I was working in the golden era of hip hop and Biggie was huge, you would have like the fans of Public Enemy saying, oh, Biggie's ruining hip hop. He's only talking about that materialistic shit. And then I would just kind of laugh.
Really?
Because Biggie was multi-platinum. It would be like, yeah, okay, whatever. Bitter old man. And I kind of say the same thing now. Because as I hear my generation saying, oh, mumble rap, you can't understand what they're saying. But then I go to the club and I see 2,000 kids bouncing to, you know, to 21 Savage or to, you know, a Metro Boomin beat or to Future or to whatever. And it's like, okay, you can be mad all you want, but these kids love this shit.
Yeah.
And this is becoming their golden age of hip hop.
Right.
Yeah. That's true.
That's a good way of putting it.
And I noticed that it's harder for the older artists. And even when I started working with Trouble, I was nervous. Because when I started working with him, he was 26 or 27. And he's 28 or 29 now. And I was really worried that kids would say, oh, he's too old.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard, like I'll sit down, you know, when kids don't understand that I work with rappers, right? So I'll sit down with them and say, you know, hey, do you like Trouble? Yeah. Do you like 21 Savage? Oh, yeah, he's my dude. Okay, what's the difference between Trouble and 21 Savage? Because they kind of sort of rap about the same shit. Oh, well, young 21 Savage is so melodic and, you know, he's like my age. you know, Trouble's like the OG.
Wow.
Like, oh, shit. Okay, he's the OG, huh? Wow. 29.
Right.
Wow. That makes me really old. So I've noticed like a backlash for older rappers. Like the new rap fans don't embrace older rappers. Like it's almost like if you're older than 23, you're too old.
But they say hip hop is a young man's sport though. So
it is, and yeah. it was when I was coming up too. You know, when I was coming up, there were some older rappers, and the kids didn't embrace them. I remember some kid saying to me, it was Jay-Z's, like, maybe fourth or fifth album. And I remember a kid, I was speaking at a high school about the music industry. And it was right around the Nas-Jay-Z beef. So I guess that was, like, around 2002, somewhere in there.
Yeah,
and
right.
The kid said to me, I said, you know, our generation was all battling, you know, who made the doper diss, Jay-Z or Nas. So, you know, I asked this kid, I was in the high school asking this kid, you know, Jay-Z or Nas. And, you know, kids would say, oh, Nas. The other kids would say, oh, Jay-Z. And this one kid said to me, nah, who cares? Like, man, Jay-Z, man, he looks like my dad. And I just, like, I stopped in my tracks and I looked at him and I'm like, he looks like your dad. I'm like, how old is your dad? And he said,
right.
Yeah, my dad is, I don't know, like 35. And I'm like, oh, shit, Jay-Z's probably 32. Okay, I get it.
Yeah.
So I backed off because, okay.
Right.
Okay. 13-year-old,
like
somebody who's 30 looks old, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, it's just the fact that, like, you know, that mentality that the kids have, you know, it's just, you know, I always hear people say, you know, pay homage, you know, and I think about when I was coming up, you know, I came up in the 90s, you know, and, you know, we always still have respect for Bambada and Grandmaster
Eric B. and Rakim, Big Daddy Kane,
yeah,
and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
we did.
Just, you know, it's just like
but
we paid homage.
This generation still respects, for the most part, not everybody, but they still respect Tupac and Biggie, which is like
right.
Our Bambada and our Cool Herc. The only difference
True.
Is Bambada and Herc kind of invented this, so they get a little bit of extra oomph on the respect. But
indeed,
it's, you know, aside from maybe a handful of kids, most of the new generation, they call Biggie and Pac old school, but they respect them. It's not like they're like, oh, fuck them, they can't rap. You know, I've heard one or two people say that, but it's very rare that I'll hear somebody say that.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's always, I always ask young kids, I do the same thing, Wendy. I ask kids, you know, hey, what you got in your phone? Because, you know, they always got all the music in the phone. And they say, I got some old school. I'm like, what you got? And they'll say, I got some Tupac and I got some Biggie. And I'm like, okay, young blood, you doing good? Okay,
exactly.
All right. Yeah, so.
I remember the first time, like, somebody said, I got some old school shit, and I'm thinking, oh, cool, they got, like, Slick Rick. What you got, Rakim? Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, and they're like, yeah, I got Bone Thugs, and I got Biggie. I'm like, whoa, I'm old.
Wow,
yeah.
That's crazy, man.
Bone
yeah.
Thugs is old
crazy.
School? Oh, shit.
Right. Right. Yeah,
but then,
let me
and
get
I thought
life.
About it, and it's like, okay, you know what? That was 20 years ago, so I, okay,
True.
Yeah.
True.
I guess so.
If you think True. About it, they've been dead over 20 years, right? Biggie and Pop. So.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
That's crazy.
Yep.
So what do you think about, you ever think lyrical rap will come back, Wendy?
Yes, Biggie. I do. I think Kendrick Lamar has proven that lyrical rap has value. J. Cole is proving it. I think that people that
Drake.
Want to... I don't consider Drake lyrical, but he is. I consider Drake more of a pop artist. And I think rap is going more pop. And I think that the guys like... And J. Cole is more pop. I think the guys that can be more melodic, like the Chance the Rapper type rappers,
right.
I think they're going to do better in the long run because they reach women as well as men. You know, they're still lyrical enough where the guys like it, but it's melodic enough where the women feel like it's for them too.
Yeah. Yeah, you gotta include the ladies. You got to.
Exactly.
To stay in it. To stay in it. The ladies gotta be on board.
Yeah, like for what I do, I prefer, like right now, if somebody's not lyrical, I pass on working with them because it's coming back to the lyrics again. And even the street dudes, like if they're not lyrical, and Trouble is not in this batch because I started working with him 3 years ago. Not to say he's not lyrical, because he can make some wordplay that's pretty amazing, but I think we can all admit that he's not the most lyrical rapper. Like, he's never going to battle Kendrick Lamar. It's just not realistic.
No, no.
But in today, with the way the business is going, if an artist comes to me and they're older than 25, I pass on working with them. And if they're not lyrical, I pass on working with them. Because that's the direction that I feel it's going right now. And that may change, but for right now, that's where it is.
Okay. Wow. Lyrics are back.
What about overseas versus America making money? Is more money overseas?
I can't speak much on that because I don't focus on international. So what I do, I really have to be hands-on. And for me to break an artist overseas, I'd have to physically go there. And it's just, it's too much of a learning curve for me. I leave that for others that you know, are more inclined to want to do that. So I don't focus on overseas at all for my clients. I just focus on building them here.
Okay. All right.
But lyrics, like, I didn't know if you wanted to go in that direction, but lyrics matter overseas more than they do here.
Right, because it seemed like a lot of the old school artists are making a living over there, making a lot of money over there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. Still torn and doing, and just getting money over there seemed like it. Yeah, I know Wu-Tang is real big. Probably Slick Rick. Everybody just overseas getting money, seemed like it. I hear a lot of interviews and everything, so.
And maybe that's the market to go to once you get older in hip hop. You know what I mean? Like,
right. Maybe that is where you go, provided you had a viable career here. I don't think you can be 40 years old and start rapping and hit Europe. I think you need to have some renown here in order to go there. But I think that you also, like, they don't, you know, our streets are very different than European streets or Asian streets. So the street rap is a harder sell because they don't understand the lifestyle.
True.
They can't relate to it as much as they can relate to, you know, other topics.
True. You know, I remember being in Korea, and just being blown away when there was Korean guys, you know, quoting Tupac lyrics to me. You know, and we all know Pac, you know, people always say, oh, he's a gangster rapper, but, you know, Pac, in my arguments, I always say Pac is one of the only rappers who touched almost every emotion human being can have. So to have people, you know, all the way over in, you know, Korea, South Korea, that you know, say that they feel Pop, you know, and it goes back to what you were saying as far as being lyrical, you know, being lyrical and being able to, you know, and just having something that people can connect to, just like you were saying with Trouble, you know, with him having that quote from his song and people not ever being his friend, his fan, being able to connect to that phrase. So, yeah, I mean, lyrical, yeah, being lyrical, I think that, you know, going back to what we saying, lyrics coming back, I think that will take you further.
I agree.
I think that
people can really relate to, if I care about something, I could get hurt, and I don't want to get hurt. Therefore, I can't get involved too deeply.
Right.
And that's what the T-shirt says. I can't get involved too deeply.
Right.
I like that.
I'm gonna have to go get me one of them.
I like that. I really like that.
I love it.
So, Wendy, you never wanted to start a label?
No, I don't like the whole day-to-day of running a label. Also, once an artist gets to the point where they've blown up, it's not fun for me anymore. I really like breaking artists. I really like... I like the point where I have to make phone calls and explain to somebody why they should be playing my artist. Once my phone starts ringing and people want to know, can they get a feature? Can they get this? Can they book a show? It's not as fun for me anymore. It's just, it's more fun to take somebody that has nothing and make something. And then I leave it to others to take them to the next level.
Yeah, I think that just because you're so passionate about the music itself, you know.
I think so. And I don't like the politics when it gets to that level. It becomes almost, you know, the phone calls come in from people that did very little or something to help you, and they say, "Oh, you owe me this or you owe me that," and it's like, no disrespect, but I don't owe you shit. Like, you know, we paid for everything as we went along. I make sure that I only work with artists that have budgets for this exact reason, because I don't want anybody to be able to come back and say, you owe me. But those calls come in anyway. It's disparaging to me. The politics are disparaging to me.
Right. Wendy, do you ever see yourself walking away from this?
I'm going to have to at some point, I'm going to have to at some point. I'm 53.
Okay.
I don't want to be 80 working in the music business. So, yeah, at some point I'm going to have to stop. You know, it's funny. When I started, I was 30. And I said, I'm just going to do this for 10 years. And then at 40, I said, okay, I'll do it for another 10. But absolutely, I'm going to stop when I hit 50. here I am at 53, and I'm still taking on clients. So, you know, it kind of takes me a year and a half to 2 years to do what I do. So it's not like I can just stop, you know. I can't wake up December 1st and say, okay, I'm done. I'm going to have to plan ahead like 2 to 3 years, you know. And I haven't done that yet. So I'm going to be at least, you know, probably 60 doing this. But, yeah, at some point I'm going to have to stop.
So y'all heard it. Y'all need to get at Wendy now. You know what I'm saying? Y'all need to get at Wendy now.
She's not going to stop. She's just saying that.
That's funny. Sometimes I feel like I'll never stop. And then I have days, like there was a day last week where I was like, I'm done. Fuck this. Like, I hate this. I don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I guess we all have days like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but...
What a good thing about hip-hop now, though, I can say it don't matter the age, because I know some lyrical cats that's 40, and now they can actually put it out themselves now. Yeah, I mean,
exactly.
You don't got to really search for a record there.
That's beautiful.
Yep,
that's beautiful. It's just hard to build a star at 40 unless they've been doing it for a couple years. Like, I think that 2 Chainz was a good example. He was 38 when he finally exploded, but he started, like, building his career when he was 30 or 33, you know? So he was older, but it's not like he woke up at 38 and said, I'm going to start rapping.
Right.
Because it takes a while to get on. I mean, even Trouble had put out 4 albums before I started working with him, and it still took me 2 years to get him to blow.
Mm.
Consistency is the key, though, right? Staying consistent.
Yes. And a lot of damage had been done with him. I had to undo a lot of damage. Yeah, they got a little ghetto when they were working him the first time. They were like trying to extort DJs and shit. It was ugly.
Oh.
They didn't know any better. They were young, you know. They were young and they'd play my record and they'd lift their shirt and there'd be a gun in their belt. It wasn't trouble. It was the guys around him.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when I got with him, the first thing I had to do was remove everybody out of his circle except for 3 people that I knew weren't knuckleheads.
Got it. Yeah, and the company you keep is, you know that's you know, whoever the, you know, people in your circle, sometimes they can bring you up or they can bring you down.
Exactly.
That seemed like it was a necessary move for him to get up, but it's good to see that he's having that success. Most definitely.
It is good. He deserves it. He's earned it. He's a very hard worker. He's a good dude. His heart's in the right place.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Definitely going to stay tuned into the websites and everything. I'm glad we had this conversation. I'm going to stay tuned and learn.
Yeah, me as well. I've been watching your moves for years now, and just been amazed in the stories of the things that you've done, and just getting a chance to chop it up with you is an honor, man. It really is.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. There's so many people that will reach out to me and say, "Gee, I haven't heard your name in 10 years. Are you still in the music business?" And it frustrates me a little bit because nothing's changed. I just don't hire a publicist to announce everything that I'm doing. And it's almost like because I don't do that, people think I went away. And I haven't stopped. I've been doing the same thing, for 25 years, just quietly.
That's amazing. That's amazing in itself to have, that amount of experience, and longevity in doing it and still have a love for doing it. That's admirable.
Is the podcast out now?
Yes, they're at rapinomics.com.
Okay.
They're also on iTunes. You can go into iTunes, into the podcast app, or you can go to SoundCloud. I've got them up on SoundCloud, too.
Okay.
If you search Wendy Day Rapinomics on SoundCloud, it'll pop right up. There's about 5 of them up right now. 4 or 5.
Definitely, we're going to be plugged into that. Everyone, you got to give it up to Miss Wendy Day. If you ain't amazed by what you've heard so far, you need to go and check out everything. All these sites that we've been talking about. Go get the podcast. I know most of y'all got them iPhones, so damn it, go to that podcast
YouTube
app on your phone. Make sure you jump on that YouTube. Make sure you subscribe and hit that notification button. Otherwise, you'll miss that live talk.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And guys, thanks for doing what you do, because I know there's no money in this, and I know you're not making money doing this, and I just love the fact that you're taking the time and the effort to do what you do. Most people don't do that. Most people don't do shit unless they're getting a check. So hats off to you guys. I love you guys for
Appreciate that.
We love the culture, because me and Q45 would sit here and talk for 4 hours about hip hop.
All facts. So, well, thanks. We appreciate that. And we're going to continue doing it. The podcast lane, we got the internet radio station. We're moving towards more monetary gain, but even if it wasn't that, we still would do it. Absolutely. You got any more questions?
I'm gonna definitely stay in tune with Wendy, and I got some music. But, I'm going to definitely learn about the producing thing on her live streams. I'm going to go back and listen to that and just to see, get some knowledge on that. And I'm just glad you're going to keep dropping videos.
If there's something I didn't cover, hit me in the comments on YouTube or email me.
Yes,
my email address is all over the YouTube page.
Definitely.
Just let me know what's missing. And if I can't answer it, I will go find somebody that can. I'm about to start adding interviews into my YouTube page, which I only haven't done it because I don't know how. And I'm sitting down with Jordan, I think on Wednesday or Thursday, and he's going to teach me how to record interviews and then edit them so that I can start interviewing people for my YouTube channel.
That's awesome.
So if I can't answer questions, I'll certainly find somebody that can and interview them.
That's the great thing about it. We can actually leave a comment or send you an email about a question, and you can respond. That is so great.
Yeah. The fastest way to reach me is by email. Now, if you send me music, I won't listen to it. I just get too much music. So So rather than play favorites, I don't listen to any of it. But if you send me a question, either I'll answer you if you're looking for an answer, or if you're suggesting a topic, just let me know. And
topics, that's
I'll turn
exactly
it into a topic. The comments, I lag a little bit because I get so many of them. It takes about a week for me to respond on YouTube in the comments. I usually go in on Wednesdays and answer. So if you hit me on Thursday on a comment, it's going to take a week for me to respond.
That's cool. Yeah, no, that's all right.
But even
whenever you got time, I mean, just as
24 hours.
I mean, and you probably have some answers already on there, so that's what I'm looking for. So,
hey, I'm here to bear witness. Wendy is very responsive to email.
Very,
you know,
really appreciate
very,
it.
Very,
I'm here to bear witness.
I can't brag about my phone time. If you call me, sometimes it takes me a week to return your call, but for email, I'm usually back in touch within 24 hours.
Appreciate that. Really appreciate that. Appreciate you.
It's just all about time in the day. I can be on the phone with a client and answering an email at the same time, but I can't be on the phone with two different people at the same time.
Exactly.
You know? So it's just returning phone calls is really hard. I get like 300 calls a day as it is. No.
Yeah,
exactly.
We don't want to bother you like that. That's the stuff. Well, Law, you got anything else, brother?
Nah, that's it. It's just an honor just to talk to Miss Wendy Day, man. I'm just still in awe.
Yeah,
well,
I am too.
I really appreciate the fact that you'd even want to share what I do with other people. I think that we can really make a difference in this industry, because if people know what's fair and acceptable, they won't fall for the bullshit.
Exactly.
And that is why I do what I do.
Y'all heard it right here.
And that book, one more time, Ms. Day, the book that you got out now?
It's called How to Get a Record Deal, and you can get it on, if you have an iPhone, you can get it on iTunes, which the book version of iTunes is called iBooks, or you can get it on Amazon.com. It's digital, so you're going to have to download it to your phone or your computer or a tablet.
When they also got the audio book as well?
Yep. The audio book, you can get that at iwantarecorddeal.com.
Okay. I heard that. Well, now make sure you get that. Support Miss Wendy Day. She's here for everybody that's trying to get to it. All you independent artists, man, y'all need to invest in yourself. Get some game. Link up with Miss Wendy Day. And,
I know she got that documentary coming soon on herself.
You know, I probably will never do that.
Really?
It makes me a little uncomfortable to talk about myself. Not to mention there's things that I guess I've been privy to that I would never say out loud. So unless I were willing to give up the secrets, I don't think it would be interesting to watch a documentary on me. So I can't say for sure never, but it would surprise me. I don't think I'll do it.
Okay.
It's really not about me. It's really about making a better climate for artists so that they can make money and support their families and, you know, get their music out there.
Wow. That's what it is.
That's always been my goal.
That's what it is.
All right, appreciate
but guys,
it.
Guys, thank
really
you so much for your time. I appreciate you so much.
Appreciate your time, Miss Day. You know, and we definitely will be supporting you, and we're gonna make sure that you get out. Like I said, we're gonna send all these links over to you. You know, so you can see what we do.
I'll put them up on all my social media.
Hey, we appreciate that.
I'm happy to do it.
And we appreciate that.
I even have a section on my YouTube page where I put interviews. So if you stream this on YouTube, I'm happy to link it on my page as well. And I've got about 2,000 subscribers right now. So
awesome! Wow. Awesome. We need that. Yes, man.
We appreciate
there you go.
It. We definitely
happy to do it.
Absolutely. Well, there it is. Y'all got it right here. RoundUpRadio.com. Get Built 101. BUBM Radio. It's Wendy Day. The icon, the legend, the
the power player behind the scenes, making things happen for artists
and talent.
Yes, indeed. You're built from the ground up.
Built from the ground up.